Winter weather returns to Montana and is here to stay for the next few days. Good evening, I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Connor Ballantyne, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
We'll also tell you about the farm bill the U.S. House passed today. And in tonight's feature interview, News Director Sally Mock talks with U.S. Senator John Tester about his longtime mentor, Max Baucus. Law enforcement have been responding to vehicle accidents all day long as a result of the late January storms that have affected much of our listening area. National Weather Service meteorologist Dave Noble says this system's not done with us yet and could bring particularly slick conditions by tomorrow morning. Noble says this very moist Pacific weather system has affected most of our listening area. Some lower valleys were expected to warm into the mid-30s, changing the snow into rain this afternoon.
And the problem there is the ground temperatures are still cold, so there could be some glaze of ice that could occur. Main roads are probably going to be treated, so side roads might be kind of slick.
Meanwhile, Noble says the snow is expected to continue through the night. 3 to 6 inches could accumulate in some valleys with up to a foot of snow in the mountains.
And then another bout of snow late tonight and tomorrow morning. There's an Arctic cold front that's going to slide south and west over the Continental Divide and kind of push through the Flathead Valley tonight and then edge close to Missoula area by tomorrow morning. It's interesting, there's going to be some probably pretty decent snowfall ahead of this frontal boundary across west central Montana. Some places are going to see some snowfall rates of 1 inch per hour at times. So a second bout of snow, we're looking at 8 to 10 inches in the Flathead Mission Valleys. Could see up to a foot of snow, Sealy Lake, Condon area, and several inches Missoula southward.
The winter blast doesn't end there.
As this Arctic front pushes westward, it's going to be some gusty winds, going to see some blowing snow, especially like towards Ovando. Driving could be pretty bad across western Montana come tonight, tomorrow morning. We're looking at actually kind of a cooling trend for the next week or so. You know, this is a pattern change from the milder weather we've had. We're going to start seeing some colder temperatures as some of that colder air out of Canada starts to kind of push down here. So we're going from highs in the 30s to highs in the 20s by Sunday, and then could see some highs in the teens by Tuesday and Wednesday of next week.
More on the weather later on in this broadcast.
And in other news from around the state, the House has passed an almost $100 billion a year compromise farm bill that would make small cuts to food stamps and continue generous subsidies for the nation's farmers. The vote was 251 to 166. The five-year bill now goes to the Senate, which is expected to send it to the president's desk. The measure had solid backing from the House GOP leadership, even though it makes smaller cuts to food stamps than they would have liked. The bill would cut about $800 million a year from the $80 billion a year program. That's about 1%. The House had sought a 5% cut. Chris Christians, project director and lobbyist for the Montana Farmers Union, says he is happy with the vote today. What's more, he says the nearly $4 billion of livestock disaster assistance included in the bill will greatly aid farmers and ranchers.
Those funds ran out originally in December of 2012. And so when we had disastrous fires in southeastern Montana that took out all of the forage and the fences and all of those things for farmers and ranchers, and then also had some severe winter losses, and of course everyone's aware of the storm in South Dakota in October of this past year, these farmers and ranchers had no disaster relief. With the passage of this bill, they will be able to have retroactive assistance for providing help to the farmers and ranchers who lost livestock.
The bill also provides funds for the Livestock Indemnity Program and the Livestock Forage Program. Christian says despite the delay in the passage of the farm bill, the bill provides some stability for the state's agriculture industry.
Our producers now will have some certainty and will be able to stay in operation in our rural communities across the state. Agriculture is still the number one industry in Montana. And without a good farm bill in place, we really aren't kind of hanging out there.
A vote in the Senate could come as early as next week.
The farm bill that has cleared the House includes a one-year extension of a federal program that compensates rural counties for federal lands they can't tax. About 1,900 local governments, mostly in the West, received a total of $400 million last year under the program known as Payment in Lieu of Taxes, or PILT. More than three-quarters of the money went to 12 Western states, with the largest shares going to California, Utah, New Mexico, and Arizona. Lawmakers in the West had howled after the program was omitted from a budget deal approved this month. Rural communities rely on it for basic services such as police and fire protection and road maintenance.
Ravalli County employees working to reconcile the books in the treasurer's office found more than $800,000 in checks that hadn't been cashed. Last week, county commissioners voted to place Valerie Stamey on paid leave after complaints about overdue disbursements and reports. On Monday, the Department of Revenue gave the county until next Monday to make a $4 million tax payment for October through December or face an estimated $37,000 penalty. The state believes the county owes about $4.5 million. Yesterday, county workers told the commission they found nearly $802,000 in property tax checks dating back to November and December that hadn't been posted into the county's accounting system and deposited. Workers hope to have that cleared up by today. The commission plans to meet tomorrow to discuss interim management of the office.
The Air Force's nuclear missile corps faces new strains after dozens more officers were implicated in an investigation of cheating on missile launch proficiency tests. The number of implicated in the probe has roughly doubled from the original 34 officers, meaning that about 14% of all launch officers are now sidelined. Officials said yesterday the number of officers implicated now approaches 70, all at Malmstrom Air Force Base, which is responsible for 150 Minuteman III nuclear missiles, or one-third of the entire Minuteman III force. The scandal is one aspect of a growing array of personnel problems facing the Air Force's nuclear missile corps. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel says he wants to find quick solutions. He is hosting a meeting of top nuclear officials today at the Pentagon.
Cascade County commissioners have voted to rezone property on the northwestern edge of Great Falls to allow seed and herbicide maker Monsanto to locate a wheat breeding testing site there. The Great Falls Tribune reports the county is taking public comment for 30 days on yesterday's decision to change the zoning from commercial to light industrial, which would allow the inside storage of chemicals. Last spring, Monsanto announced a new wheat technology center near Twin Falls, Idaho. Monsanto spokeswoman Sarah Miller says regional sites will support wheat breeding testing, and Great Falls is one of those sites. Monsanto has signed a five-year building lease that is contingent on the zoning change. Monsanto's job listing for a wheat testing agronomist in Great Falls indicates that person would be managing 20 to 30 test plots.
The president of a private nonprofit economic development firm says Montana's first community fiber optic network is going to be a boon to Butte area schools and businesses alike. A 28-mile ring of fiber cable is providing what Meredy's Jim Cambich says is super-fast internet service to 12 Butte public school district buildings and a few select businesses and nonprofits. The Butte Silverbow Public Library and other businesses are slated to connect to the service soon. Other nonprofit agencies and for-profit businesses will tie in as more capacity becomes available.
We have broader bandwidth, faster bandwidth. It's more interactive. We have developed a high-speed, multiple gigabit bandwidth that is totally dedicated to that network. You're not on a shared network at all. And it creates a very solid learning environment, in particular for school districts, where you can integrate projects and they can span across multiple grade levels and can have a fully collaborative learning experience.
Cambich says this fiber pipeline can deliver 100 megabits per second. So, does that mean Southwest Montanans will soon be able to game or stream Netflix programs without worrying about annoying buffering slowdowns? Nope, not yet, anyway.
I think that's a little bit in the future, but you just never know. I think as communities want to reach out and make things happen, it's a very expensive proposition. And I think one of the things that we see is we want to try to bring these fiber optics to underserved markets. And basically, Montana in general, our bigger cities are not wired. We're basically underserved markets. So our next step is to continue to work in the education arena and bring this forward to the communities to enhance and education and the opportunities, and also work with communities to help us be more competitive on the worldwide level.
Cambidge says the new fiber ring will hopefully make organizations and businesses give Butte serious consideration when looking to build or relocate.
Senator John Tester will become Montana's senior senator in only his second term once Senator Max Baucus is, as expected, confirmed as the new U.S. ambassador to China. News director Sally Mock is in Washington, D.C. this week, interviewing both senators about the transition. In tonight's feature interview, Sally talks with Senator Tester about his longtime mentor. Tester says he was starstruck when he first met Baucus at an economic development meeting in Havre in the late 90s, just before Tester himself entered politics.
I see people on TV as public figures, and he was bigger than I anticipated him to be. You know what I mean?
So, just physically.
Yeah, physically bigger. And so it was interesting.
Did you bend his ear about the farm bill?
Actually, no. I was kind of taken aback and somewhat, I guess, from my perspective now, very timid to approach him about issues. I was more just wanted to meet him and shake his hand. He's somebody that had served in Congress since 1974, which happens to be the year I graduated from high school. So he's been in this position all my adult life. So at that point in time in 1998, he was well into his career, of course, and somebody that I'd seen and heard speak, but only from a distance. So I was kind of in awe of him at that point in time.
And had no idea, obviously, that someday you'd be his colleague in the Senate.
Yeah, none whatsoever. It was not on the radar screen at all.
And yet here you are, and it's, I'm sure, important that you've had him as a mentor, because he is someone who had such vast experience when you began. He wasn't somebody who'd only served a term or two. He was somebody you really could go to and say, not only where's the restroom, but what's going on?
Well, I mean, as you know better than anybody, Sally, I mean, Congress works, but it's a different kind of place. I mean, it doesn't work. It's similar to the state legislature, but it's certainly not the same. Things are much slower. You've got to have patience to be here. But from a Max perspective, and my relationship with him, it was great. He's somebody that I trust. He's somebody that I could go in, and I knew he wouldn't take me into a hornet's nest. That he would give me counsel that I could use, and really, he did that, and give me advice that really helped me. Early on, particularly, because this place, even though it was similar to the legislature, it was very foreign. And so he gave me the kind of advice that I needed at that point in time to, you know, keep my powder dry on certain issues, or on other issues to go out and speak my mind. And I think that, you know, there are some people in Congress that talk a lot. And I think that Max has always been one who... advice has been, you know, talk when the issue is important. When it's important to Montana, when it's important to the country, and you'll have much more credibility. And I've kind of tried to stick to that.
You mentioned when you were introducing him at the confirmation hearing that when you were considering whether to run for the Senate, that he said to you, make sure you have the fire in the belly. That was good advice, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely, because I didn't know what I was about to enter into. He did. And he knew that if you didn't have the fire in the belly, you'd never make it through the process. He knew if you didn't have the determination to see this through and to win, that you wouldn't make it very far. And he was absolutely 100% correct. I didn't know. I mean, at that point in time, yeah, I was all gung-ho and wanted to do it. But he did put a different set of terms upon it. And I'm talking about the run for the Senate, because it's very difficult. I mean, it's very hard, and it's unfortunate it's as hard as it is, and it's gotten harder over the last 10 years. But the bottom line is that Max knew that you wouldn't be successful unless you had that fire.
Have there been moments in your term so far in your service in the Senate where you've had a particularly difficult time or difficult issue, and you've turned to him and he's helped you on that?
You know, I'm sure, and it's intentionally so. We serve on different committees. And so, consequently, when I need to know information, you know, he serves on Environment and Public Works, he serves on Ag, and he serves on Finance. When there are different issues out there that I want to know how things are progressing, I go to him, and he comes to me on appropriations, Indian Affairs, Veterans Affairs, banking, and the like. I can tell you that we talk every week, and we visit about what's going on our respective committees and what's going on the floor. We talk about things like where we're going to be in the state so we don't have overlap, so we can cover the state. And we talk about issues like that. Look, when I got here, the Iraq war was hot and heavy, and it was flipping, getting a lot of input. I know we talked about that extensively. I know we talked about the first immigration bill and the second immigration bill a lot, just to see what each of us thought people in Montana were saying about it. Look, I was on the floor yesterday for the vote on flood insurance, and I've just come back from Montana, and Max says, so what'd you hear? You know, what'd you hear on the ground? That's a pretty basic question that we ask one another all the time to try to keep in touch with what Montanans are talking about. And to be honest with you, Sally, that's the kind of stuff I hope I can do with the person who takes his place, that we can have an honest conversation without political agendas about what's best for Montana and what's best for the country. And that's what's been nice about Max. I knew he was never going to lead me down or into a place that I shouldn't be. And he was going to give me honest advice. I could take it if I want. I could go a different direction if I so choose. And never once has he ever come back and say, I told you so. Because I don't follow everybody's advice all the time. And so consequently, it's been a great relationship. But there's been a lot of issues. None really comes to mind right now, Sally, as far as specifically. But part of that reason for that is you know, every week we have a meeting and a conversation, so it comes up, and we probably get to it before it gets to a boiling point. I'm talking about the issues.
Because you do have the same constituents, obviously, but you have disagreed on some important issues, and when you have those disagreements, do you try to convince the other? Do you ever say, look, I think universal background checks is a good idea?
No, and usually at those weekly meetings, we'll ask one another where we're at on certain issues if there's a contentious vote coming up. And I can tell you that, he tells me, I tell him, he gives me a reason why he's going to vote, where he's going to vote, and I give him the reason I'm going to vote, and we're fine. That's it. But I guess within that reason, there's a bit of lobbying, but not really. I mean, it's usually a straight-up conversation where, look, background checks is a prime example. He voted the way he wanted to. I respect that vote. I voted a different way. I think I'm right. But the truth is that to each his own. And not everybody in this world is the same. I mean, as I said during the campaign last year many times, I don't agree with my wife all the time. You know, we have discussions, and it's the same thing here. On certain issues we agree, on certain issues we don't. But that doesn't mean I'm right all the time or that he's wrong all the time or vice versa.
Montana has had in the past a Democratic and a Republican senator. That could happen again. You mentioned earlier that you hope whoever it is that you want to have a good relationship with them, obviously. But it's sweet, isn't it, when they're in the same party?
Well, Max is the only guy from the same party I've served with. So I don't know. Sometimes, you know, you hear people in the same party that actually have a pretty difficult time back here with one another because they're in competition all the time for the same votes. I've never felt in competition with Max. Part of it is that he serves as chairman of the most powerful committee in the Senate. So, I mean, he's got a leg up on me there. But I've never felt competition with him. I've always felt like he's looking out for the best for Montana and the country, and that's what I do. And so we're both on the same page on that. And so I hope, regardless who ends up here, I hope that we can have that kind of working relationship, non-competitive, just doing what's right.
There's a lot of discussion. You mentioned Senator Baucus being chairman of the Finance Committee. That's something you get from longevity more sure. than anything. And there's still a lot of discussion about whether longevity, the benefits of that outweigh the costs, and the costs being that not fresh ideas, that someone's in office too long sometimes. And the idea that someone would serve as long as Senator Baucus is probably, I mean, that's unusual in the future probably, do you think?
I couldn't agree with you more. I think And I don't see anything wrong with folks serving a long time here. I mean, I certainly respect people who can do that. Danny Inouye was a good friend of mine. He served a long, long time here. Robert Byrd was an incredible guy. Max has done a great job. And by the way, some of the folks who served lesser times have been great. George Winovich was a great guy. I mean, you know, there's a lot of folks out there that served lesser times. It was good. But I can tell you that I think because of the third-party money that's coming in, these campaigns have been so difficult and so extreme, let's just put it that way, that I think the days of a Dan Inouye or a Max Baucus are probably over. Is that good for the country? I don't know that it is, to be honest with you, Sally. I think that when I started in this position, I was number 100, January 1 of 2007. I think I'm 52 right now. That's almost a 50% turnover in 7 years. Institutional memory is also a very good thing, and it's very important. And I think when you get turnover, state legislature is a prime example. We've had, you know, because of term limits, and I probably supported them, but in retrospect, we have the kind of turnover where there's no institutional memory, and then who has the power? The bureaucracy, the lobbyists, and I don't think that's healthy either.
You were quoted earlier in a different interview as saying that you think the ambassadorship to China, that that's a good fit for Senator Baucus, that his notion of retiring to Montana might not have been the best fit, that this is a better fit.
I do. I think, look, he has been in the public eye for a long, long time. And the reason I say that is because when I went to Helena for the state legislature, it was 4 months of very, very intense work. And when I got out, there was kind of a decompression that had to do, a reentry, so to speak. And it took a while. I mean, most folks will tell you when they go to the state legislature, it takes a month or two to get back. Max's been here for 39 years. I mean, this has been what he's known for a long, long time. And that reentry would have, I think, been very difficult. Now, each to his own, it might not have been. But for me, it certainly would have been. And so he, I think, stepping into this position, I think it helps him personally for that reintegration back. And then the other thing that it does for the country is that you've got somebody in China that is very invested in trade, very invested in making sure that we create a relationship with that trading partner that's the best it can be. And so I think it helps the country, and I think it helps him. I think when he told me he was not going to run again last spring, I said, "What are you going to do, Max?" And I said, "You going to lobby?" He said, "Nope." He says, "I'm going to go back to Montana, and I'm going to, you know, utilize the great outdoors that Montana is so famous for." And boy, I appreciate that. I think that's marvelous. I just think it would have been very difficult to come out of a situation where you're dealing with people and press every day and go into a situation where it becomes a lot more solitary. That change is tough. So I think this helps everybody.
Sally will have a feature interview with Senator Max Baucus tomorrow during Montana Evening Edition. Baucus is expected to soon be confirmed as the new U.S. ambassador to China.
And now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide tonight, there is a winter weather advisory in effect until 11 a.m. tomorrow for the Kootenai Cabinet region, the Flathead Mission Valleys, and the Butte Blackfoot region. There is a winter storm warning in effect until 11 p.m. tomorrow for the West Glacier region, the Lower Clark Fork region, and the Bitterroot Sapphire Mountains. Tonight, snow and rain are likely with lows 19 to 26 degrees, and tomorrow, snow is also likely with highs in the 20s. For central Montana tonight, there is also a winter weather advisory in effect until 5 p.m. tomorrow for elevations below 6,000 feet for central and southern Lewis and Clark counties, as well as in Hill, Toole, Liberty, and Blaine counties. Winter storm warning in effect until 5 p.m. tomorrow for the Rocky Mountain Front, Eastern Glacier, Cascade, Shoto, Eastern Ponderay, Eastern Teton, Judith Basin, Fergus, Mar, and elevations above 6,000 feet for central and southern Lewis and Clark counties. Tonight should be cloudy with snow and highs 5 to 10 degrees, and tomorrow expect mostly cloudy skies and snow through the day with highs in the teens. For southwest Montana, there is a winter weather advisory in effect until 5 p.m. tomorrow for elevations below 6,000 feet and a winter storm warning in effect for elevations above 6,000 feet for southwest Montana. Tonight should be mostly cloudy with snow likely and lows 15 to 25 degrees. West winds could be 20 to 30 miles per hour with gusts to 35 miles per hour. Tomorrow expect mostly cloudy skies and snow is likely. Highs are 25 to 35 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Mark Hansen.
Mm-hmm. 50 years ago, President Lyndon Johnson, in his State of the Union address, declared an unconditional war on poverty. Last night, President Obama took the same stage once again to highlight the tragedy of poverty perpetuated by obscene and corrosive inequalities. Given the half-century between these speeches, it would be easy to conclude, as President Reagan did already in 1988, that the war on poverty is over and, as he put it, poverty won. But that's the problem with persistent and complex challenges. We're too easily tempted to buy into the stories that let us off the hook. We tell ourselves a story in America that we are a people who have built our country on hard work, individual responsibility, and independence. That we are a people of faith in a God who rewards good effort, the best outcome for which is a materially comfortable life. Government should be small, and the free market solves problems best. So when we talk about poverty and income inequality, it's not uncommon to hear complaints about parents simply needing to take responsibility for hungry kids or for their own health care, and how we shouldn't have to subsidize others who can't find work. On top of that, it's easy to buy into the idea that with a record number of people now living in poverty, government programs to stop it are a waste of taxpayer money. Such simplistic views are fodder for anti-government politicians who love to perpetuate them. In her response to the State of the Union address, Representative Kathy McMorris Rogers depicted herself as a woman who once worked at McDonald's, but who now works in the U.S. Capitol. She touted a vision where the free market, not the government, empowers you out of your poverty. Her story might fit the American vision, but she might also want to talk to fast food workers who now strike for better pay and who aren't, without government assistance, able to afford the college degree and executive MBA that she got. Many people are so disadvantaged that a fast food job is the best they can hope for, despite their efforts. The fact is, the free market alone keeps them in poverty. She might want to see if corporations and wealthy individuals receiving subsidies would be interested in a free market without government assistance, too. The problem with many views like hers is they're not rooted in complex reality. First, many anti-poverty programs actually work. A recent study by the National Bureau of Economic Research, using updated assessment techniques, found that between 1967 and 2012, poverty would have risen 6% without government programs. In 2012, they reduced child poverty by 12%, and without them, deep child poverty rates would be as high as 20% during economic downturns, as opposed to the 4-6% we observe with government programs. Food and nutrition programs have been especially effective in reducing poverty. Second, poverty is not simply a matter of individual responsibility. One of the greatest determinants of an individual's poverty is being born into it. Children who receive poor nutrition and education, who are born with fetal alcohol syndrome or into violent households, are often trapped in a cycle of poverty with no way out. 42% of food stamp recipients in Montana are children. Third, we have a moral responsibility to end poverty. The obligation to love the neighbor and alleviate suffering is central to the religious traditions in our American story, too. And some problems cannot be tackled through individual charity or the free market alone. Poverty is one of them. The problem is not, as President Reagan suggested, that poverty has won the war. The problem is that we didn't fight hard enough. There is no moral defense for policies that suppress the minimum wage and cut food stamps, unemployment benefits, and other programs that alleviate the suffering of the poor. It is even more obscene to do so while touting tax breaks and policies that benefit primarily the wealthy and large corporations, while actually doing little to create jobs. It is time to start holding politicians who support such misguided policies responsible. We might start by electing fewer millionaires and more people who truly understand the complex reality of poverty. The solutions are in front of us. They include not only food stamps and raising the minimum wage, but also innovative programs like expanded pre-kindergarten education and the Nurse Family Partnership. So let's not slouch back onto simple stories about how the poverty of others is not our responsibility and merely fosters dependency. how it can be solved by the free market or individual effort, or how it can't be defeated at all. Let us resolve instead to support the programs, public and private, that will enable a future president to declare that the war on poverty has been won. This is Mark Hansen, guest commentator for the Mansfield Program in Ethics and Public Affairs at the University of Montana.
Mark Hansen is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Madeline Beck. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.